In this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Andrew Ransom, a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, studying the early life history of Lake Whitefish. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Our guest today is Andrew Ransom. Andrew is from a small town in Northwest Connecticut. He completed his bachelor's degree at the University of Connecticut in 2015 before working a few seasonal jobs as a fisheries technician for the Connecticut Inland Fisheries Department and the Idaho Fish and Game on the Kootenai River. In 2017, he was accepted for a master's project at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, looking into early life history of Lake Whitefish and major Wisconsin tributaries to the Green Bay. Welcome to the podcast, Andrew.
Hey, Nick. Thanks for having me on.
Andrew, you also roped one of your lab mates, Lydia Dorr, into coming on the podcast. She will be talking about her project on next week's episode, so we won't spoil the full intro here, but she is another graduate student at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. She also happens to be studying Lake Whitefish. Welcome to the podcast, Lydia.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, no problem. Andrew, I grew up in Iowa, and I'm working in Kansas now, and I have never seen a Lake Whitefish, or never seen one or never held one. So tell me about Lake Whitefish. What do they look like?
So they're actually in the salmonid family, so the trout and salmon. And they're kind of a bright, shiny, silver-looking fish, big forked tail. They have these cool little, like, short faces with a big eyeball, and they're very tasty.
So their scientific name is the same as for gizzard shad. Do they look kind of similar to gizzard shad?
Similar, yeah. They don't have quite as tall of a body, and on the gizzard shad, there's a big tail coming off the dorsal fin, but the lake whitefish do not have that.
Are they just as slimy?
No, they're still pretty slimy, but they're not as bad as a gizzard shad.
Lydia, were you going to say something?
I was just going to say that their mouth is subterminal, and they have like kind of fleshy lips almost that they kind of use to forage on the bottom.
They're kind of more foragers and not so much filter feeders like some other common prey fish, or I guess, are they a prey fish or are they more a predatory fish?
So they're a benthic forager, but they also get predated upon by the larger, more predatory species like muskie and pike, but they kind of mostly feed off of things on the bottom.
So they get fed upon by kind of muskies and pikes, and so they're kind of important in that aspect in the food chain, but do they serve any other roles? Are they a commercially popular fish or recreationally popular?
So they are actually the world's largest strictly freshwater fishery. Within the Great Lakes, there's I'm not remembering the exact numbers, but there's like $15 to $20 million a year fishery on just the lake whitefish.
And there's also a huge sport fishing community that has reestablished on the ice on Green Bay in the winter. They're becoming a really popular ice fishing sport fish with the reestablishment of the Green Bay population, probably starting about 15 to 20 years ago was when the people really started fishing them hard, and now there people come up from all over the U.S. to ice fish whitefish on Green Bay.
They must be pretty popular if people up there are going fishing for them over walleye or muskie, or you guys even have lake sturgeon that you can spear through the ice, so they must be pretty fun fish to go after if they're going for them through the ice with all those other targets.
They're delicious.
Oh, they are delicious?
Yeah.
Yep. And they fight really well, too.
So, Andrew, what got you interested in working on these? How did you get from Connecticut to Wisconsin Green Bay?
Well, do you want the full story or the abbreviated version?
That's up to you. What do you want the world to know?
Oh. All right. I've always kind of wanted to try to work around the country, and this is kind of a perfect profession to do that. And, like, the early professionals part of my career. So I was able to work back home for a seasonal stint, and then I moved out west trying something completely different out on the very northern section of Idaho. We actually used to go up into Canada twice a week for work, which was a pretty incredible experience. Then I actually drove all the way across, back across the country, and had another job with the state of Connecticut doing the same thing. And the whole time I had been trying to get into grad school and saw this project come up. And so I applied and went through the whole process and got accepted. And so moved back halfway across the country this time again. And now I've been in Green Bay and I've been loving every minute of it.
It wasn't just a deep passion for Lake Whitefish or the Green Bay Packers that drew you there?
No, actually, I had never seen a whitefish until I moved here. And actually being from not too far away from Boston, I'm actually a pretty big Patriots fan. So I try not to let people know that.
Well, here's a tough one for you. Who's better, Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers?
Ooh, I think I got to go with Rodgers on this one.
I'm a Packers fan, so I'll have to agree with you on that one. All right, and your project is looking at the early life history of these fish. I guess first, what do you mean by early life history, and why is looking at it important?
My project is basically focused around the spawning, egg development, and then when the eggs actually hatch out, and then they become a larvae. And then that's kind of where my project finishes. So they hatch in the rivers, and then they get pumped out into the bay. And then I'm not really sure where they go after that, but I'm trying to look into seeing what kind of habitat the adults are actually seeking out to spawn on, seeing how flow plays into everything, because that's a completely new environment for them. And then eggs actually incubate for 4 to 5 months, which is an extremely long time for an egg. Say like a walleye, that's only a 2 to 3 week time period, I think. And then by the time they go through this whole 4 month process, are they hatching out large? Are they small? Do they have a big yolk sac? Kind of the, what condition are these fish coming out of the egg as, and seeing how that kind of compares to what could potentially be happening in all of the other, the more historical sites.
Do lake whitefish run up the tributaries and spawn, and the eggs drift back out into the main lake?
Actually, they sit in the rivers until they hatch out. So they do come up. They actually come up about as far as the first dam on all these tribs, which is fairly normal kind of spawning migration behavior now. And then the eggs sit there until they hatch out in the springtime after everything is not frozen anymore.
So they run up in the fall, and then the eggs sit over winter and hatch in the spring?
Yep. Yeah, actually, they're spawning probably the next 2 weeks or so, middle of November.
Are you going out looking at these fish while they spawn to try to figure out what kind of habitat they use?
Yeah, actually, I just kind of got started on that portion of my project for my second season of it. But I go out and I use this really cool camera that uses sound waves instead of normal visual light. And so I can see all the fish in very turbid, murky, dark environments where normally normal cameras wouldn't work. And so I have a set number of points where I go check in 2 of the 4 rivers that I'm covering and try to see where they are, and then also kind of when they show up, so we can try to tie it into some kind of a, is the water temperature sort of driving these? Is it the day of the year or some kind of a discharge factor? So we're trying to figure out really what causes the timing for these migrations. And then also I get kind of the substrate and the flow that also goes along with that for where they're actually choosing to spawn.
Yeah, that was a tough one. With my graduate research project, I didn't have the fancy camera or anything, but I looked at catch rates and tried to figure out how some of those factors affected the catch rates of paddlefish, because some days you'd catch a whole bunch and some days you wouldn't. And I tried everything with flow and time of year and water temperature and all sorts of stuff, and I could never figure it out.
Yeah, I'm still not at the trying to figure it out part yet, but I guess we're going to see.
Take all the data you can. Maybe one of them will be the one that gives it to you.
Yep, exactly. There's no such thing as too much data.
Until you have to analyze it or enter it all.
So you go out this time of year and you look at the adults spawning, and then, like you said, the eggs kind of incubate under the ice or in the water over the winter. And then in the springtime, they start hatching. Do you do any work with them once they start hatching and they come out of that larval stage?
Yeah, actually. So that was kind of the main reason for my project, actually, is that how many larvae are there actually kind of coming out of these rivers? And so I go out and I start in early March and I have a net with really fine mesh on it. It's about a millimeter wide spacing in the mesh. And I drag that around in the rivers and try to catch some larvae when they're out there swimming around.
So then once you capture the larvae, what do you do with them? Do you just count them, and or do you have to put them all in alcohol and take them back and ID them in the lab over winter?
We do have to bring them all back, one for the ID, but also as part of Lydia's project, she's trying to figure out if you can tell the tributary of origin from their otoliths, which is their inner ear bone. So we need all the samples we can get to run that through the, I forget what the machine is called.
Mass photospectrometer.
Have you had one of your larval trawls yet that's just been chock full of fish to the point where you're wondering what the heck you're going to do with all these fish yet?
Yeah, we've had a couple days where you do one trawl and you sit there and you count for an hour and a half. They're also very hard to catch. They're very small, they're hard to see, and they have a lot of energy. So they're zipping around, and we have to pipette them all by hand. So we have to pick them up one by one, which can sometimes take a while.
I can imagine. I hope the graduate student in school do larval trawls for Asian carp on the Mississippi River and tributaries in between St. Louis and the Ohio River. And there were days where we could have filled a 5-gallon bucket up with some of the larval toads we did. And luckily I never had to help him ID or count any of the fish during the winter time, but I imagine it was quite a pain to sort through all those fish.
And one of the benefits of doing our field work so early in the spring is that whitefish are really the only thing that are hatching at that time. So it's pretty easy to ID the larvae because it's pretty much only whitefish until the very, very tail end of our season. So that's kind of a bonus.
We covered the using the hydroacoustic technology in the fall to sample the adults and the larval toes in the spring to sample the larvae. I guess, are you looking at the eggs before they hatch, in between the spawning and the hatching?
So with the camera, we can only really be so sure of exactly where they're spawning. So we can see some of the higher densities of fish in certain areas, but it's kind of hard to for sure know that that's actually where they're spawning. So after the spawn is done, I also go out with a called a suction sampler. It's kind of like an egg vacuum. And so we go out into the river and we basically just sample in a grid the entire section where we were in with the camera, and so we can get an egg density at each point and try to see if the highest density of eggs corresponds with the highest density of fish to just kind of confirm that this is actually where they're spawning.
Well, it sounds like you have quite a bit of field work and quite a bit of lab work to do on top of it too. It's gonna be a busy year for you before you finish up.
Actually, the stuff with the eggs, we just put the eggs back after we're done for the day. We don't really do anything with them besides just to see where they are, which is nice for the lab side of things anyway.
Well, Andrew, thank you for filling us in on your graduate project, and best of luck to you in the future, counting all those larvae in the coming months. But now we're going to have a little fun and do a little quiz to see which of you is the real expert about lake whitefish, Lydia or Andrew. So, Andrew, you said you've listened to past episodes, so you probably have an idea of how the game is played, but set up like the old show Card Sharks. So I alternate asking one of you a question about lake whitefish characteristics, such as how old they get, and then the other one will guess higher or lower.
Yep, I think I'm ready.
All right. So just like the times before, these numbers were all taken from fishbase.org, so they might differ from some of the other journal articles you might have read, but It's a nice way to get a whole bunch of information real fast about a whole bunch of different species. So, Andrew, we'll start with you. What is the maximum reported age of a lake whitefish?
I have to say 32.
All right, Lydia, is it higher or lower?
I'm going to say higher.
1 point for Lydia. The maximum reported age is 50.
Ooh, way off.
All right, Lydia, what is the maximum length of a lake whitefish?
Oh, man. Sorry, I'm now looking at a meter stick. I would say, like, let's go 650-ish millimeters.
Andrew, is it higher or lower than 650 millimeters?
I'm going to go higher.
That's 1 point for Andrew. The maximum reported, or the maximum length of a lake whitefish is 100 centimeters or 39 inches.
Wow.
The average size of this fish is 1.5 to 4 pounds. But Andrew, what is the maximum published weight of a lake whitefish?
These are really, I'm going to get some like larval questions.
I'm going to go 3.2 pounds.
I think that's lower than.
That's lower.
What you said.
The average size is 1.5 to 4.
Oh, average. Okay, sorry. 8 pounds.
All right. Lydia, is it higher or lower than 8 pounds?
Higher.
All right. That was almost too easy for Lydia. The maximum published weight of a lake whitefish is 42 pounds.
Where are they getting these fish from?
All right. So we have a bonus question here. And the first one of you to answer it gets the point. In what year was that 42-pound fish caught from Lake Superior?
1920.
Andrew, do you have a guess?
1939.
Lydia was pretty close. It was 1918 they caught that.
Yeah, they get really old up there because it's so cold and they grow so slowly.
All right, Lydia, what is the length at which lake whitefish become sexually mature?
About, I think, 17 inches, so 430-ish millimeters.
All right, Andrew, higher or lower?
Lower.
All right, fish base says 257 millimeters, or about 10 inches. So that's 1 point for Andrew. And we're on to the final question. It's tied 2-2. If I was generous and gave the bonus question to Lydia, it's 3-2 for Lydia. So Andrew, the final question is a little bit tougher. How many dorsal and anal spines does the lake whitefish have?
Dorsal, I'm going to say 14 to 16, and then anal 10 to 14.
Lydia, do you have a guess? Or higher or lower?
Maybe a little bit lower on the dorsal, and I would think that the anal would be pretty spot on.
All right, well, it was a trick question. So that's how many dorsal and anal spines they have, and lake whitefish don't have any spines. But if my memory serves me right, you're pretty close on the soft rays on each of the fins. So we can give the point to Andrew and give it a tie so you guys don't have to fight over who the real lake whitefish expert is.
I think it's her.
I think we're going to fight it equally. We're both good at very different things.
And there weren't really too many larval fish information on there for me to ask those sort of questions. So sorry about asking about adult fish.
Oh, it's okay.
That's okay. Yeah.
That's the reason we get to do the research we're doing. There's
not a lot of larval stuff out there.
All right. And as I mentioned, these numbers were all taken from fishbase.org. And this is a large free source of information for an abundance of fish. So any fish question you have, head over to fishbase.org and they probably have the answer you're looking for. Unless you're looking for larval lake whitefish information.
Then come to us.
Andrew and Lydia, thank you for playing along. And now we'll move along to the final five questions. And I'll just ask Andrew this time around, and Lydia, you'll get your chance in the next episode. So Andrew, you listen to most episodes, so you're probably aware that this is a group of five questions that I ask each of the expert guests that come on the show. And as always, we start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
I'm going to have to go with a striped bass on that one.
All right. Any reasoning why the striped bass is your favorite?
I actually grew up catching them off of the coast of New England, and that was my first really big fish that I ever caught, and I've just been trying to go back and catch them as much as I can ever since.
What is your favorite memory from your career thus far?
I think so far it's been getting to work with the white sturgeon subspecies that I got to work with out in Idaho. It's pretty cool to see an 8 to 9 foot fish just coming up out of the water somewhere where you can like stand about 10 feet away from where the boat is. So that was pretty neat.
I can only imagine. I've caught 3 and 4 foot lake sturgeon on the river, so I can't imagine seeing one twice that big.
That was the first one I had ever seen, and it was pretty incredible.
You're pretty early in your career, but you've traveled all over the U.S. working different jobs. Do you have an idea what your dream job or dream location is?
Dream job is a biologist, basically just anywhere. I'm pretty open to where I'm going to end up, and I've been able to find really cool things about everywhere I've been, so just biologist somewhere.
And if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
So if money was not an issue, I would like to work up kind of around the North Pole, trying to figure out how 8 months of ice cover changes predator-prey dynamics, feeding rates. Just kind of, there's just such what seems like a huge gap that we just don't know about what happens under the ice. And I enjoy the cold weather, so I think I'd like to get up and do that if I could.
I was just going to say, you must enjoy the cold weather working in Connecticut and northern Idaho and now Wisconsin. You must really enjoy the cold weather.
The colder the better. I don't know how people hike around in waders all the time in 90 degrees.
All right. And the final one, if there is one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Get outside. We're in theory in this profession to save the resource and to protect nature. And I think we need to get out and start to use it more so we have that much more passion to protect it.
Andrew, thank you for voluntarily coming on the podcast today. And thank you for dragging Lydia along with you. It was a pleasure hearing about you and your graduate project. And best of luck to you as you finish your project. And then are you done this semester or next semester?
Next semester.
All right. And if people want to find out more information about you or your project, or just to get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
You can probably send me an email. It's RANS04@uwgb.edu. You can send me an email about anything. I'm always happy to chat about fish stuff. And yeah, I just want to say thanks for having me on. Been a pretty big listener since the first episode, so I hope we can keep this going.
If you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email at feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Listen in next week when we will flip it around and I'll talk with Lydia Dorr about her master's project. You can download and subscribe on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 15th episode of The Fisheries Podcast. And remember, get outside.